And trauma. She works remotely now, I assume, not always, but right now she works remotely with individuals and couples, and she regularly presents to communities, educators, and mental health professionals. She's the clinical director of the Layers Project magazine. She hosts a weekly IGTV series and has been a featured expert on various websites. She's a graduate of CUNY, Queens College, that's City University of New York for the non-New Yorkers on the call. And Rachel earned a BA in history at Queens and was a merit scholar at YU's Wurzweiler School of Social Work. So Rachel, thank you so much. We're super excited.
Thank you so much for having me. Lynn and I were actually on GEO together at SKA. When I was in ninth grade, Lynn was in 10th grade. And part of being on GEO was we got to go up to the Shabbaton on Thursday night and everyone else came on Friday. That was like our big part.
We had a lot of fun.
Anyway, we had a lot of fun. Yeah. All right. It's so great to be here. I love getting to know communities outside New York. For one thing, people come on time or early, which is like refreshing and that reminder. And I just am so honored to be part of these conversations. I very much feel like I am part of this conversation. We are having these conversations together. The people that are joining us live have the advantage of being able to ask questions. And so it's really important to me that we have time for that. So the way we're slotting it is I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then we'll have about 20 minutes for questions that will hopefully lead to more discussion. So you guys can ask questions live. This is not being streamed live anywhere else right now. So I just wanted to put that out there. So I spoke two nights ago for a JOMA webinar, and that ended up on YouTube. So I'm going to try not to repeat too much stuff, because I feel like if I'm here live, I'd rather give you guys more stuff. And if you want to hear some of the other stuff, you could look at that. This is not me trying to plug myself on YouTube. I just feel like I want to give people as much of myself as I can in the amount of time I'm spending with them. So I'm going to start with a story. Oh, before I start, I'm not here in any halachic capacity. As you can see, there are other people in the community who you can turn to for your halachic and hashkafic challenges. I'm not here in any sort of posketing role, and I dodge those questions very, very quickly. So if there's going to be questions later about kind of what do I think about certain halachas, I'm definitely not going to answer that on a Zoom recorded video. So just want to put that out there. So we started the story. When I was in college, I was at a bridal shower of a friend of mine. And it was a very typical New York bridal shower, Sunday morning brunch, you know, bagels, tuna. It was always my job to bring strawberry mango salad. This was when like strawberry mango salad was like the thing. It was like a super expensive salad to make. I don't know why I always volunteered to make it. But anyway, so it was like a typical bridal shower. And then at one point we're all sitting around in a circle watching the bride open presents and yet be surprised, even though she registered for those presents, but it was still super exciting to open the presents. And I would say 75% of the gifts that she received were lingerie. And it was like trashy lingerie because I don't think we understood then the difference between lingerie. So we just like would go to H&M and just buy the first lingerie to, it'll be like, oh, here, we got your lingerie. But anyway, so 75% of the stuff was lingerie. And I was sitting in the back next to one of the great aunts. She was like one of these funny, like Betty White type of personalities. And finally, another present was open, more lingerie. And this aunt, I don't know, I'll call her Edna. Edna turns to me and says, "You guys got her a lot of lingerie. Do you think she's going to be spending more time in the bedroom than in the kitchen? Why didn't any of you get her a peeler?" It's like a very, very good question. Like, why didn't any of us get her a peeler? I don't know. I guess getting a peeler wasn't as exciting as buying lingerie at H&M. But when I think about this story, what comes to my mind is how, back then in college, when people were getting married and then, again through our 20s and 30s, whatever, that's in terms of who you are, regardless of religious affiliation, how long you've been together, sexual history, there's often this notion that you're going to get married and you're going to have a lot of sex. Sex is going to have a lot of fireworks. Things will go smoothly. It won't take work to connect in love. And that as years go on, it's just going to happen on its own. And I think there's different ideas that feed into that concept. It's not just secular ideas of love. I also think there are, Bashar Zivog, those ideas of love can also feed into that idea. But the reality that relationships take work is a fact, not a failure. And it's something that continues for people as the years go on. Now, Dr. John Gottman is a big researcher on couples, and he has studied couples over the years. And he was curious about couples that stay together to look for patterns. And I want to throw out first that I believe there are times where divorce makes sense. And I'm not one of these people who thinks that, like, okay, if a couple's together for a long time, that automatically means that they have a very strong marriage. He was curious to see, were there certain patterns about certain points along the way where people seemed to be staying together or not staying together? And what he found was that the couples that he saw getting married and then getting divorced within a couple of years of the marriage, he was seeing a lot of high conflict. But the couples that were getting divorced, let's say like 15 to 20 years, 16, 17 years of marriage, he was seeing more of emotional disengagement. So what we're looking at with emotional disengagement, we're looking at two people who are living under the same roof, sharing finances, a family, friendship, community, sharing a lot of things, but not really connecting. And so, yeah, there might be conflict, but there's this sense of growing apart, the sense of not feeling close to one another. And in long-term relationships, there's often an interplay between emotional connection and sexual functioning. What happens in the bedroom affects the relationship outside the bedroom and vice versa. And anyone who says otherwise, I highly disagree with them. I think that everything affects everything. Nothing in a relationship stays in one little corner. And the proof of that is when a couple is having stress around sex, it seems to come up in arguments that was not what you were originally talking about. So it's like they're disagreeing about something related to finances or some other topic. And then before they know it, it's like, okay, well, like you never want to have sex. And it's like, oh, wait, how did we get here? Right? Because sex is often lurking under in terms of the way it affects things. And sometimes people ask me, how important do I think sex is in a relationship? And I say, okay, well, it depends. It depends on the couple. It depends on their particular libidos and things like that. But I'm a big analogy person. And the analogy that I often use is like this. So think of electricity. So when a couple is having positive sex, so positive sexual memories, positive touch, it gives a certain brightness to their relationship. Certain electricity gives a certain brightness. Okay. Now, let's say for whatever reason, sex can no longer be on the table. Maybe it's for a short period of time. Maybe somebody's sick. Maybe someone just had a baby. Maybe someone is grieving. Or maybe there's been sexual dysfunction for a while. Okay. And it's not just a phase. We're talking about a longer period of time. So then we're not running on regular electricity. Then we're running on a backup generator. Okay. So what's the backup generator? The backup generator is a thing that keeps the lights on in the relationship when the regular electricity is not there. So these are things like commitment, friendship, shared values, parenting, hobbies, spirituality, all these things that kind of keep the relationship going, even though sex is not happening or it's not happening in a positive way. Now, most buildings are not cut out to run on a backup generator long term. And when you have a backup generator on, it affects what you could do. So if the backup generator is on and I have the air conditioner on, so if I plug in a blow dryer, forget it. Like we're toast, right? So when a couple is running on a backup generator in their relationship where there's a strain related to sex, or they're just feeling very far away from each other, there's a sort of fatigue, and it feels a little bit like any little thing can kind of shut things off where they can end up in conflict. And so I say to couples and I say to individuals, whenever I'm training, college teachers, whatever it is, I'm like, listen, like every couple needs to have a backup generator. It's important to have a backup generator. It's important to have the things that you feel give a sense of strength to the relationship when sex isn't happening. And so that's how I look at it in terms of the brightness piece. And sex brings up a lot of feelings for people. It could bring up excitement, security, pleasure, love, bonding, playfulness, satisfaction, even spiritual connection for some people. But it can also bring up other things that could be associated with feelings of disappointment, emptiness, anxiety, shame, sadness. And it can mean different things to you at different points in your life and at different points in your relationship. And sometimes it could be about stepping out of your comfort zone and being adventurous. Sometimes it could be about enjoying the familiar and predictability. And I find that very often when a couple is having issues around sex, people are very focused on their interpersonal dynamic and not necessarily reflecting on their intrapersonal dynamic. And one of the ways that is helpful is kind of questioning ourselves. So I want to spend a couple minutes kind of going on a little unpacking expedition with you guys, and you don't need to answer me. I'm just going to put out some things that I find are helpful for people when they're trying to get more of an understanding, more of a working language for themselves of what their relationship concepts are, what their sex concepts are. And then it gives more of an insight and understanding about how they are or are not connecting with their partner, or why they might have fears of finding a partner or looking for a partner again. So one of the first questions I like to ask is, well, how did you learn about sex? Can we do, can people raise their hands? Is that like a thing here that they could do it anonymously? Is that possible for people to raise hands anonymously?
I mean, they can raise their hands and—
That only, I can see.
Yeah, and
only
see
I can see. Them. Okay, fine, okay. So I want to do like a quick poll, okay? Who here learned about, and again, no one else can see your responses. I'm just curious for my own, and then I'll reflect it back. Who here learned about sex from a parent, like from a conversation with a parent? Just raise your hand. Learning about sex from a conversation with a parent. Not so many. Okay. I see about like seven people. Who here learned about sex from a friend, like a conversation with a friend? Okay. A lot more. Wow. Okay. Who here learned about sex from some kid on the bus? Okay.
Just those of us who went to Hal.
Hey, I went to Hafter.
Forgot about that, the same thing.
Okay. Who was that kid on the bus? Anyone hear that kid on the bus? It's okay. People tell me that my kids are going to be that kid on the bus. My kids are on the bus. They are not that kid on the bus. But I tell my friends, well, listen, even if my kids are that kid on the bus, it will be accurate information, okay? And you'll thank me later. But yeah, no, my kids know that we do not teach other kids about sex. We let the other mommies and daddies teach those children about sex. But anyway, but when you think about sex ed, and I do think that nowadays it's a little better. I think parents now are understanding that, like, if you don't teach your kid about sex, they're going to learn about it from somewhere else. And there's a decent chance it's not going to be couched in the values and messages that you want it to. So you better kind of get there first. Well, I find that for most people, when they learn about sex, they learn about sex in the context of procreation at best. That at best, this is what two people do when they want to make a baby, when they want to have a baby. And it's not usually taught from a context of pleasure. And even anatomy, okay, if you Google diagrams, and this is like a pet peeve of mine, it's often labeled female reproductive system. And I have a problem with that because when you look at what goes on, there's a lot more going on besides for potential to reproduce, right? So yes, you have your vaginal opening and that's where your period comes out of. And yes, you know, a baby can come out, all that stuff. But you also have like clitoris, you have urethra, you have anus. Like there's amazing things going on there besides just potential to have a baby. But we call it reproductive system. Okay. So I've always joked that I want to make a motion that we rename it the female multipurpose room because there's so many different things going on. But this is an example where we just associate vaginas with procreation. We just associate femininity with procreation, even breasts, right? Procreate or feeding a baby. And not necessarily teach girls at a young age the connections to what does it mean to experience sexual pleasure, even if we're not going to get into a whole conversation about sexual pleasure at that time, though plenty of kids masturbate. So a lot of them are discovering it already. But in terms of the earliest messages about sex, these don't make people doomed for life, but these things are relevant. And I find that they're helpful for people to have an awareness over. Okay. And for girls especially, the messages around sex could be very difficult because it's like as a teenager, there could be this message of, you know, don't get pregnant, don't get raped, don't be slutty. But like somewhere in there, hopefully celebrate your body, celebrate being a sexual being. And when you get to be in the right relationship, you'll slip right into a healthy mindset and body space about sex. And it's all going to somehow add up in a smooth way. So That I find is difficult for many, many people. And that's why I think it's helpful to kind of take this bigger picture look of it's not just about what's happening right now or not happening right now in your relationship, but like kind of getting more of an understanding of yourself. So the first question of asking yourself even is just like your earliest messages when you were growing up. And everyone has early messages, and that doesn't mean everyone is doomed, but it gives awareness. You know, your parents' marriage is the first marriage that you were exposed to. What did love look like in your home? What meaning did sex have in your home? What did you learn about comfort and connection from the people around you? Who were the safe people in your life? If you didn't have anyone safe, how did you comfort yourself? What was touch like in terms of being okay, encouraged, discouraged? When people hugged, was it like a quick tap? Was it like a holding people close? What did people look like or act like when they were angry? What was the attitude about emotions in general? Just expressing emotions. Because I find that when you're in a culture, a family culture, where there's shame about expressing emotion, there can also be shame about experiencing emotion. Was there vulnerability? What did it mean to be vulnerable? Did people open up and share their feelings? Did people take accountability when they made mistakes? What was the attitude about aging? Even about being a mom, about being a woman, being a sexual being, right? Were these attitudes that were like negative or positive? Some people might say, oh, I didn't hear any messages. And I'm like, well, no message is a message. Okay. And then your experiences during your formative years. What did you learn about sex? What did you learn about relationships? What was your experience when you hit puberty? Was it confusing? Did you feel prepared? what was your experience with tampons? Did you wear tampons? Were you not allowed to wear tampons? How did that affect the way you related to your vagina? What was your experience? Even were you exposed to pornography as a kid? And what kind of takeaways did you get from that? Experimentation, past relationships, romantic relationships, crushes, unrequited love. And then there's trauma, which, like we say, could be big T, little T trauma. Sometimes, oftentimes, it's not about what happened to us, but who is there to hold us. And we hold energy in our body. We all hold energy in our body. There are people that when they're stressed out, their back is bothering them or their neck is bothering them. And, you know, you have vaginal muscles, you have pelvic floor muscles, right? So how you're feeling stress-wise can affect your muscles there too. Even understanding your romantic attachment history. What was your experience like in the dating world? If you're still in the dating world now, what's the experience like for you? What was it like for you dealing with uncertainty and rejection? What was your courtship like with your spouse? Were there things that you anticipated to be an issue that have become an issue? Were there things that you didn't anticipate to be an issue? Yes, there's usually issues that you did not anticipate to be an issue. Have there been times where you were able to be vulnerable? Were there times where you took a risk to be vulnerable and it didn't land in a way that made you want to continue being vulnerable? Have you been betrayed emotionally, sexually? And when I say betrayed, I mean by friends also. I find that when I talk to any woman and really unpack things, very often there could be experiences from childhood relating not just to guys, but to like female friends, betraying them, leaving them out, ditching them, all these kinds of things that I think can also play a role, because very often friendship drama can precede relationship drama, like romantic drama. Because like, people will have friendship drama and trauma in like second or third grade even. And those things can also have an impact on people in terms of feeling a sense of belonging and connection and worthiness. Now, body awareness is so important. So I look at body awareness as like, what is it like for me to live in my own skin, right? What does it feel like for you to function in your own skin? And I often say you can't host a housewarming party in a house you don't live in. And so if you're never home in your body and sex is the only time where you start paying attention to your body, sex is probably not going to be so much fun. Because if all day our body is sending us memos through our feelings, if we're shut off and muted from that, so the idea that then you're going to jump into bed or wherever you might be having sex and then be able to feel positive feelings in your body when you've been totally offline all this time, for most people is not realistic. And there's so many things that our body does that we do that we're not even conscious of. Like I had this happen a couple of years ago. I was in the supermarket and I was standing in front of the produce aisle and I forgot my shopping list at home. So I was trying to figure out like which fruits I needed to buy. And I'm standing there and I have the shopping cart next to me. I was by myself in the supermarket. And after a couple of minutes, I looked down and I realized I'm rocking the shopping cart back and forth. There were no children in the shopping cart, but I was rocking that shopping cart back and forth for a couple of minutes. Okay. I don't know if people were staring. I don't know. Maybe my Cheerios felt very relaxed, but that's an example of something where I like wasn't even conscious of it, but it was like so autopilot for me that I'm like holding something that's on wheels. I'm just pushing it back and forth. So even just bringing your awareness to your body of what is it like for you to reside in your body? What are your feelings about being in your body? What's your feelings about pleasure? What's your feelings about feeling good? Can you see yourself as someone who's attractive? Can you see yourself as someone who deserves to experience pleasure? And I do want to say there is a survival benefit to being checked off, to being offline from your body. And it's not just from a trauma perspective. I find even think about times where, let's say like you got woken up at 4 a.m. by a kid in your house, if you have children, or if let's say, you know, you were up super early because you had to catch a flight somewhere and you're up for a couple hours, you're running around, you're doing a million things. And it's only after being up for a couple hours that you realize that you've had to go to the bathroom for the last 4 hours. So that's an example. Or even like a Friday afternoon, you're super busy dealing with a million things to get ready for Shabbos that you just didn't eat lunch. And normally you're someone who eats lunch and your hunger cues just weren't so strong because you were so focused on doing other things. So that's an example where there's like a benefit sometimes for people of being checked out from their bodies. But then when we transfer that to sex, where you want to be experiencing pleasure, it gets a little tricky. So, and even just, you know, also looking at your, who your role models are, work, who they are now, the culture you grew up with in terms of your social culture, there's different levels of culture. Educationally, it's very helpful to think about if you took college classes, if you're married and you took college classes, to help, it's helpful to look back and ask yourself kind of, what messages did you get? Were those messages helpful? Were they stupid? Were they like really setting you up for failure? At the same time, though, I find people love to blame their college teachers for things, but I'm like, okay, but what about the 20 years before that? You know, in defense of college teachers, this person gets dumped on their doorstep after 20, 25, 30, 35 years of living in the world, living under, you know, in someone else's home, whatever it is. And it's, to think that a college teacher is going to totally reprogram everything is just not realistic. At the same time, though, college teachers do have a certain power. And I always tell college teachers whenever I train them, I'm like, there's a chance that you're the first and last person that they're going to talk to about marriage and sex. So you better know what you're talking about. So I know I'm a little, I like to just lay it out. Sorry. But so there's all these different pieces that contribute to the ideas that we enter relationships with. And when you look at sex scenes in a book or in a movie, it usually goes something like this. You have two partners, their arousal, their libido and arousal are totally on par. Like, it's, they're just making out, they're taking off their clothes. It's happening really fast. You know, assuming it's a heterosexual couple, his penis slips right in. She doesn't have to guide it and show him like which hole or be like, oh no, that's my butt. Like, no, his penis just slips right in. There's no, you know, no one's reaching to put lubricant on. He thrusts until ejaculation. They climax at exactly the same time, like synchronized swimmers. And then afterwards they relax and they're having pillow talk. And so there's no lubricant often. Nobody farts in the middle. His penis doesn't slip out. No one falls asleep in the middle. No child walks into the room in the middle. And if it did, it would be considered a comedy. The woman orgasms from intercourse. They orgasm at the same time. There's no cleanup afterwards, if you notice. And I've yet to see a movie where after the couple has sex, they're laying next to each other. And the woman says, oh, let me go pee so I don't get a UTI. Okay. I've yet to see that. Okay. So again, no matter how much you inhale media, there's a lot of ideas that people pick up around sex. And so we develop a lot of myths. So I want to go through the myths quickly because I also want to leave time to talk about just also sexuality through the lifespan for couples, because I think that a lot of people wonder like, what are other couples dealing with? Or like, is this normal? And, you know, and things like that. So the first one is this idea that when you love someone, they should just know what feels good for you and that you don't need to articulate what you need. And this is, I think, a learning curve for a lot of couples, because it's something that also changes with time. The types of touch that you like often can change with time. People, their preferences for how they like to be touched change, and a partner needs to be updated on that. People often think that sex is for people with young toned bodies, and that as you get older, your sex life has to go out the window. And I always joke that whenever I read about that, how there are studies out there that there are plenty of women that as they get older can actually feel more comfortable in their own skin. I always think about the Lohmann's dressing room. If you've been to the Lohmann's dressing room, you know what I'm talking about. It's like a big room. All these women would be changing into bathing suits. And as a kid, we didn't understand, like, how are they so comfortable with themselves? Like, and you know, we're all like looking away, waiting for the dressing room, one dressing room. A common myth, or I think misunderstanding for people, is this idea that keeping Taharas Mishpacha is going to be a perfect recipe for an exciting sex life and will mean that automatically that your sex life will be never boring and just have this automatic deep emotional bond. And I think this has gotten a little better in college classes, this kind of flowery idea that keeping these laws are just going to be automatic. The comparison I often give is like, if we taught kashrus the way Taharas Mishpacha is often taught, it would go something like this. We'd be like, okay, listen, you got to keep kosher. Okay. Your food is going to taste better. You are going to have a healthier body for sure. And when you're in Disney World and you're walking around and you're seeing all these people eating like that big turkey drumstick and having a ball, you're going to be like, nope, I don't care that I can't eat the food here. I am so excited to eat my hot tuna sandwich that's been sitting in my foil, right? We don't teach kashrus that way. We teach it as laws, and we recognize that these are laws that we've been commanded to keep, and some people may find them meaningful, some people not, but this idea that they're a panacea, right? We don't teach kashrus that way, but Taras Mishpacha is often taught that way. And what ends up happening is then I find a lot of people feel disappointed years into marriage, because when they're having college classes and they hear their college teacher talk that way, they're like, and they're not married yet and they haven't lived with their partner yet. They're like, oh, okay. Like I guess it's going to work this way. This like whole sex thing is super powerful, I guess, you know, and then years of being married, they're not necessarily feeling that same, you know, or they never felt this magical thing about Taras Mishpacha, and then they feel resentful. I look at it like this. I don't think that keeping Taras Mishpacha is an automatic vehicle to having an exciting sex life. Because the truth is, if you don't have a positive sex life, what are you counting up to? So if you don't have a positive sex life, Nida is going to be very, very negative, because you're like keeping all these laws, but you're not even like feeling excited about what's waiting for you at the end. And so I do find it helpful for people to ask themselves what they were taught about Taras Mishpacha if they came into marriage with ideas about that, and kind of working through that a bit. Because I also find that mikvah is often taught in this very fused way with sex and a very fused way with marriage. And so what ends up happening for a lot of women is that where they're at in their marriage and where they're at in their relationship is so fused with mikvah that it's very difficult then for mikvah to feel like something that's for you. Okay. And I'm sure this might come up later in the questions, in terms of, you know, things about that. Another thing is this thing that if a woman's not lubricated, it means she's not turned on by her partner. Everyone has different types of lubrication. People have lubrication in their eyes, in their skin, everywhere. So there, some people have just drier vaginas than others, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not attracted to your partner. Now, the next thing, if you don't remember anything else I say tonight, this is, I'm good to go, I'm yotze, is that this idea that orgasm is a natural outcome of vaginal intercourse. I had a lot of women who have said to me, like, can, like, you write me a letter I could bring home to my husband and tell him that? And something I do talk with other therapists about is, like, so how do we get programming for the guys, right? Women are very into, like, going to Zoom events and things like that. How do we get an event going for guys? I'm trying to work on it. But this idea that an orgasm is a natural outcome of intercourse, most women, vast majority, they say like 70 to 75% of women don't have an orgasm from intercourse alone and have an orgasm from clitoral stimulation. And this is a tough thing for people to let in, because people have a certain kind of construct of what the sex is going to look like. And sometimes they feel like there's something wrong with them. They feel like there's something wrong with their partner. Their partner thinks that there's something wrong with them. And I think like letting go of that construct is really, really helpful and healthy for people. Another one that comes up for people is this idea that you're supposed to have painful intercourse for the first year of marriage. It's one of these things that sometimes like the friends told them, oh my God, yeah, it's going to hurt like the whole first year. And I don't really understand that, because it's like, okay, so how does that work? It's your, you know, congrats, today's your 1 year anniversary. Now your vagina is going to stop hurting. Like, I don't understand how exactly that works. Yes, the first few times someone has intercourse, they may experience pain and distress or stretching or whatever, but usually there's progress. If it's continuing to hurt on a regular basis, that is not supposed to be like, sex is not supposed to hurt on a regular basis. And there are different things that can help. Pelvic floor therapy, talking to your OBGYN. I wish that pelvic floor therapy in America was like more of a standard thing postpartum, because there are a lot of women who experience pain postpartum that could be related to pelvic floor muscles. And if they go to pelvic floor therapists, they can find relief. Another thing that comes up, oh, while I'm on the discussion about painful intercourse, I want to mention vaginismus. So vaginismus is a condition that basically you have involuntary muscular contractions in the vaginal wall, which makes it either like really painful or impossible to have intercourse. And this is one of the top reasons behind unconsummated relationships, unconsummated marriages. And this is one of those conditions that like the sooner you get help for it, like the less damage it will do to a relationship. I've seen a huge difference in couples who, let's say, you know, they're experiencing vaginismus a few years into marriage versus like it's been a couple of years of it. Because, you know, sexual dysfunction, vaginismus, these things give birth to other issues also. I want to mention a few common myths I see related to male sexuality, this idea that men have bulletproof egos, right? I think that we have this construct, especially in the film world, where everyone's like, you know, ask the guy first, you know, for the shidduch, and just, there's a lot of like ideas about rejection. And I've heard many men share that with me, that they feel like there is a construct in the Jewish world and this assumption of, and just secular world also, that, excuse me, about men being able to handle rejection better than women can. But the truth is, like, men have feelings. They don't like feeling, you know, inadequate or incompetent. Sexual functioning can bring up a lot of insecurities for them. You can't fake an erection. There are men who they struggle with, you know, if let's say their partner, if they're trying to get pregnant, and so they feel like they really need to be on. And I've seen many situations where the husband might say, you know, it really bothers me that when you think you're ovulating, that's when you want to have sex with me. And it makes me feel like you just want my sperm. And sometimes the wives are like, oh, I didn't know like you care in terms of more than just having physical needs. Because a lot of women are told like men have needs, but not really getting this fuller picture that like men have emotional needs too. And they also want to feel wanted. And they also want to feel attractive, and that they don't just care about intercourse. Like there are plenty of men who also care about hugs and other types of touch as well. And the more we can give permission for them to have those expressions and longings, the more I think relationships are able to, for couples, for partners to give each other more of what they need. A big thing is this idea also that, you know, that for a man to be good in bed, he needs to have a large penis. And there are men who are very insecure about their size, and it's also not something they can really fake. And it's something they may not even talk to their partner about, but also just understanding that the same way women have insecurities about their bodies, men often do as well. And I want to just look at the time. I'm not great at the time, please. Now, wanted to talk a little bit about when you're dealing with your sex life over the years, through the lifespan, some common obstacles that come up for couples through the lifespan. So when people first get married, there's often a lot of excitement. There could also be disappointment. There's, for many people, I find the challenge of balancing your single identity with becoming a couple. If you're someone who, you know, by the time you get married, let's say you were already pursuing your profession, or maybe you're already advanced in your profession, and now you're merging with this other person into this unit, there could be challenges for people in having intercourse when they first are sexually active or when they first get married, even feeling comfortable being naked in terms of just feeling comfortable with your body. There are couples who are navigating birth control options when they first get married. Maybe they want to wait to try to conceive. Maybe they don't want to wait. Maybe they have different feelings about it. Maybe there's a rev who's suggesting or poskening for them what they should be doing. And even some birth controls, you know, affect people more than others. There's certain oral contraceptive pills that can affect libido, can sometimes contribute to pain during intercourse. Sometimes it can affect mood. So for some people, that's often a big adjustment as well. They go on the pill, and how is that affecting them? And then when you shift into becoming parents, and I want to mention that that jump to becoming parents is something that can happen smoothly for some people. For other people, it's not. There are people here on our call who are still waiting possibly to find a partner. So I want to just make it clear that like we are talking here not just about married people, but just like fertility in general is a very charged and loaded topic. Especially, I do want to mention, it's especially loaded right now in a pandemic. I have clients who are in the firm world, who are not married yet, who, you know, are at a point in their lives where the idea that they can't really, that they can't look for a partner as easily right now is deeply, deeply painful. Because for them, yes, a year or two waiting can really make a difference for them in certain areas of health. So in terms of trying to conceive, for some people, sex starts to feel like a chore, or it's based on ovulation, or then there's disappointment when they're not pregnant or not wanting to have sex because they're feeling down, or even just sex being a trigger for what isn't happening in their fertility life. Getting pregnant and dealing with the changes that can happen for people, dealing with the changes in their body, you know, dealing with, you know, now your stomach's getting bigger. Is that something that people usually are celebrating? People don't usually celebrate their stomachs getting bigger. It's a problem in our society. People are very fat phobic. And then suddenly people get pregnant and like everyone's commenting on your belly, like constantly. So there's a lot that if you could just even like that visibility in that regard. And I also want to mention in the firm world, like all of these life cycles, like people, you know, in the, I don't want to say the yentas, but people like to make comments. People like to ask a lot of questions. I have twins. And when I was pregnant, I chose not to tell people I was having twins, except for like a handful of close friends and family members, because I didn't feel like every time I told someone I was pregnant, if I told them I was having twins, it was going to add 20 minutes to the conversation. And I'm like, no, I don't feel like answering all your stupid questions. We're not even friends. But anyway, whatever. But, and then people give birth and there's a lot of physical changes, right? Dealing with the adjustment in their body. Some people have birth traumas, right? For some people, giving birth could be very traumatic. The recovery, you know, it's, C-section is no walk in the park for people. And, you know, even just, I just find with all these stages, people are always asking you, you know, people are always, always asking these questions. I always joke that, you know, when a woman is breastfeeding, so it can shift her whole marriage in terms of how she relates to her body. So I joke that when a woman is like, you know, postpartum and she's breastfeeding and she's really relating to her body mainly as a mom, but not as a partner or a lover or sexual partner to her husband, but it's really just about the baby and how she's trying to feed her baby. I joke that like the breastaurant is closed, meaning the breastaurant is only open for the baby. The breastaurant is closed for her partner. The breastaurant is closed and so is the vagina. So this is a common adjustment for a lot of couples, especially when it's the first baby and they're really navigating a lot of changes in roles. Especially because her body has gone through very dramatic changes that his body hasn't usually gone through. I've noticed actually, just in my own whatever, that there are a lot of women that after they have a baby, their first baby, their Facebook picture changes to a picture of them with their baby and not necessarily a picture with their partner in it anymore. And I get it, like their focus changes. But it's just an interesting kind of sociological observation. If I cared enough or had some time, maybe between like 2 a.m. and 3 a.m., I would love to research that. But I don't care enough to officially research it, but it's something that I've observed. And if that did happen to you, I'm not judging you. I don't think anything negatively about you. It's just something I've noticed. And I think it's something curious for us to like kind of notice within ourselves. Now, raising children and still having energy for each other is hard for people, especially, you know, you're physically exhausted. You might have kids in your bed in terms of just creating time for yourselves. I also think right now in a pandemic, people don't have a lot of separation between work life and home life and also taking care of their kids. And I also think for many parents, becoming a parent brings up unresolved conflicts from your own childhood. And that can also get exacerbated when you look at your relationship with your partner. Sometimes it happens because people will come in and say, hey, I swore I'd never become like this parent of mine. And now I feel like I'm becoming like them. Or I'm looking at my kids and they're at the age that I experienced X or Y. Or now I'm looking back and wondering, blah, blah, blah. So it's something to kind of keep in mind too. Because I think as parents, you know, becoming a parent gives us new clarity for yourself and your relationship. And you know, dealing with midlife issues that, you know, perimenopause for many women could start in their 40s. So you could have hormonal changes. And again, this doesn't mean that people can't continue to have a positive sex life, but just to understand that like these changes can happen. And I think nowadays also there are people who are getting preventative mastectomies and preventative hysterectomies. And that can also bring on menopause in a dramatic way for some, not to mention that for people who are BRCA positive or dealing with just these types of really heavy decisions, that can also affect the way they relate to their bodies as well. And something that I think happens for many people who are middle-aged is they start, their caregiving roles start to really expand. And I think that that's something that is very true and real for many people, where they're taking care of elderly parents. They're taking care of hopefully themselves and their partner. They're helping their married kids, you know, maybe with babysitting or in other ways, or fielding phone calls or trying to help their kids who are still trying to find a shidduch, whatever it might be. There's like multiple levels of people to worry about. And what does it mean to be able to worry, but also be able to shift gears and be present sexually and connect with a partner? And, you know, I think for many couples, this is a big shift, especially if their kids are moving out of the house and now they don't have as many distractions. And so their conversation is more focused on themselves. I do want to mention that right now in a pandemic, I think a lot of couples are dealing with this right now, is that their social isolation. And I think for those who do not have a partner yet, their social isolation and just, I mean, we could talk for hours about like what does social isolation do to people emotionally and relationship wise. And there's so many other places that we could go from there. And then as people get older, you know, it can be difficult because their bodies can change and they might lose certain capacities and abilities, and that can affect their sex life. A couple of years ago, there was a really fascinating article in the New York Times about grieving sex. And it was about a woman who lost her partner of many years. And she said that she didn't feel like it was socially acceptable for her to tell people close to her that she didn't just miss her partner, she also missed her sex life. And what broke my heart was seeing all the comments. There were like hundreds and hundreds of comments from people writing similar things. And it doesn't make someone perverted or dirty for missing sex, right? It's a need. It's an instinct. And it was just really interesting to see. And I find also that a lot of people get grossed out by the idea of senior citizens having sex. And I mean, the truth is STDs have become a problem in nursing homes. I mean, probably pre-COVID more, but STDs have been a problem in nursing homes because for a lot of residents, you know, their main thing was like, okay, if you don't need to get pregnant, what do you have to worry about? Well, there's other things to worry about, but I think it's curious even just to ask ourselves that, like, why is it gross us out to imagine that as people get older, they can enjoy having sex still, right? Because we have a lot of these constructs about who's supposed to be able to enjoy sex. I've had experiences where I've visited communities to speak in America and people would come up to me after to ask questions. And I remember being in a certain community and a woman came over to me after to ask questions about vibrators. You know, she had some questions about vibrators. And I'm telling you that you would not have necessarily guessed that this woman would be such a vibrator maven, right? Because our society has certain assumptions about who are the people who are, it's a difference between also being sexy and sexual. Looking sexy versus feeling sexual are not the same thing. And I think even as we just kind of start to wind down, because I want to give you guys time for questions, is to ask ourselves, what are our constructs about our relationships? And also looking at your relationship and seeing where are the ways that you're connecting well? Where are the ways that you're missing each other? Because sex is not usually... Listen, are there couples that have spontaneous sex? Yes. I think the couples that have spontaneous sex are, yes, they might have a certain libido, but I also think that they're probably connecting more in between, right? I often give this example. If most of your communication with your partner during the day is very businesslike, of like, hey, did you go pick up, you know, a new hammer? To think that like that's going to just like ease into like, oh, hey, baby, like it's not necessarily going to be such a natural progression. And I think for couples who are able to still create connection, and this is why I'm not a fan of using the word intimacy when we're talking about sex, because sex and intimacy are not the same thing. And I know sometimes in the Jewish world, people will use the word intimacy to talk about sex, but I have a problem with that, because you can have intimacy any day of your relationship. Maybe according to halacha, you can't always have sex, but you can always have intimacy in your relationship. And the more couples are able to strengthen that concept of intimacy, I find that it can help their sex life. Now, are there other medical reasons that can affect why a couple is or isn't having sex? 100%. But I think that the emotional connection, going back to that backup generator idea, but also understanding that there's a brightness that comes when the sexual connection is strong. I think when couples can have more of an understanding for themselves of that language, everyone fares better. Now, it's hard to know what works for every single couple, every person here, whether you have a partner, whether you don't have a partner, everyone has their own unique situation. But what I think is always helpful is when you start to have more of a working language for yourself in terms of where you come from, messages that you bring along, what are your expectations right now? Do you have the ability to articulate to your partner what you need more of if you have a partner? Do you feel like you guys are able to communicate well? If you're not, have you explored seeing ways that you can get support for that? Are there books you've read together? You know, there's a lot of shame about getting help for relationships. If your phone breaks, okay, let's say you have an Apple. I only do Droid, but let's say you have an Apple phone. So an iPhone. I know I just sounded like a grandma. Let's say you have an iPhone and your phone is not working well. Okay. So what do? You might like try to reset it. Maybe you look online how to fix it. And if that doesn't work, you go to the Apple store. You go to Apple store, you talk to the Apple genius, and hopefully he fixes it, right? Or she fixes it. So why does that happen? That happens because number one, you know what your phone is supposed to function like. Number two, you know where you can get help for it. And number three, you don't feel ashamed to get help for it. I've never heard someone where you're like, oh, like you want to come out with us? And they're like, oh, no, I can't come. Oh, why not? Oh, I have to go to the Apple store, right? People don't feel ashamed to say that they're going to the Apple store, that their phone isn't working, right? But people feel shame when it comes to relationships and sex life and their sex lives. But it's also partly because people question, am I normal? Is this how it's supposed to function? But also feeling unsure about where to go for help. And this is like a very natural way to ease down now, is that one of the things I really enjoy in my work as a therapist is I get to see the different communal initiatives going on around the world when it comes to relationships, when it comes to sexual functioning, when it comes to being able to ask questions. And I am constantly amazed at the resources that are being dedicated now to increasing and enhancing the way our communities talk about relationships and give people access for more answers or even just a listening ear. And that if you had a college teacher that was bad, or if you had high school education that was like really not helpful, or you're just curious about things, or you want to get referrals, that there's like people you can call. I remember a while ago, family friend told me that when she got married, she actually had vaginismus and she didn't get help for it because she's like, back then she was like she's 70. She said like back then, like there was no one to talk to. Like you didn't call your show Robinson, like you didn't have a college teacher. So the fact that nowadays there's more people that you can call, that you don't need to navigate this by yourself. And many of the issues that we deal with, you know, I know in the empowerment world, people love to say, you got this. And I'm like, I don't know. It's more like we got this, meaning we all got these problems, but like we got this. In other words, like we're able to get through things because of the we. And yes, we're very proud of you if you were able to do it by yourself. And with little kids, we celebrate things when you can do it by yourself. But there's so many things that we try to do by ourselves that we don't have to do by ourselves. And if you just think of a time in the past where there's something you were struggling with and you got that validation that was actually more common than you realized, and you're like, oh, okay. It's just, it's a really great feeling. And so I'm so grateful to be here. And I'm just, yeah. I'm happy to see these programs are happening. And with that, I will open the floor to questions.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel, for a wonderful, very expert and obviously hilarious presentation at times. We really appreciate your expertise, like I said, and your knowledge, but also your ability to talk about things very openly and honestly. There are a questions. So I'm just warning everyone. Some of them are repeats. I probably won't get to everyone, but I'm going to try to do the ones that are broader, at least to begin. And, you know, we'll see how far we can get. Okay.
Lynn, I have a question. Lynn, in the recording, yes, are you going to share in the recording that you're going to share with people? Are you going to include questions?
I think so. Emma, is there, I mean, would you?
Do I prefer not?
Rachel, yeah.
I kind of want to give a little like prize to the people who are here and say, no, because listen, I always like to know if I'm on the record. I mean, I'm on the record regardless, but I like to know if I'm on the record.
So I'll tell you, the program is maxed out and there are many women who aren't here who would have loved to be here. So
fine. Okay, that's fine.
I think it's better for them to
I will, record. I will behave. I will behave. Go on.
We trust you, Rachel.
You know, drinking coffee at 10 o'clock at night. Yeah.
Whatever works.
It's not decaf. Yeah.
I'm sure not. Okay. So what advice would you give to a couple if one has a really low sex drive and the other has a really high sex drive? How can they find the balance?
So I have 50 follow-up questions because when someone presents that kind of case to me, whether it's a couple, whether it's a clinician presenting a case to me, whether Rob calls me. So I have a lot of follow-up questions because I want to know things like, has it always been that way? Did this change at a certain point? Because sometimes people will ask that question in a certain fatalistic, like, this is just how it is and there's no way it can get better. And I'm more like, wait a second, like, can we work first? Like the person that has a lower libido, like, are there factors contributing to that that can help the situation? That person has a low libido because they, let's say, have unresolved trauma, or they're shut down in other ways, or they had a birth trauma 3 years ago, or they, I don't know, there could be lifestyle reasons and there could be medical reasons. There could be psychological reasons affecting libido. I do often find that when a couple has a wide discrepancy in their desire, it sometimes feels like it intensifies because then the partner with the higher desire is like, sometimes comes on even stronger. Like anytime they do have sex, they're just like, because like, they don't know when they're going to get it next. And then the lower desire partner is kind of like, feels like, okay, I need to do this. And then I'll buy myself a couple of days. So it then intensifies these associations with sex that are not positive. So to me, the question is not just like, how do we get more points on the board in terms of frequency? Because it's not just about frequency. Because I find whenever I'm talking to a higher desire partner and I'm like, listen, you could have sex 4 nights a week with a partner who's like really not jonesing to be there, but is just like lying there and is like, okay, like do your thing. Versus having sex once to twice a week with a partner who's, let's say, more like, okay, like I can be into that, right? Not all partners will be like, yeah, I'd prefer the second, but I find in your average long-term healthy relationship, partners want to have sex with a partner who wants to have sex. And they don't just want to feel like it's a favor. So that's my long answer to your short question, that it depends on the scenario. I think it really depends on the scenario. I think it depends if it's been that way for a long time. I think it depends if it's been a phase, right? I think it depends on a lot of things. And I think it also depends on where they add in terms of touch, because what ends up happening sometimes also is that when you're having conflicts about sexual frequency, the lower desire partner doesn't want to touch their spouse if it's going to lead to sex. And so then the higher desire partner feels even more neglected physically, not just from a sexual perspective, but just from an affectionate perspective. So it's like, oh, okay. Like I'll touch my partner if maybe like we're sitting on the couch, but like there are some from couples who won't touch outside their bedroom, right? So sometimes the lower desire partner will say, oh, I'll touch them if they're like sitting on the couch or if we're like sitting in the car at a red light, because I know that's not going to lead to sex. But when it comes to actually like laying in bed and maybe cuddling, they don't want to cuddle because, oh, my partner might get turned on and then I don't want to say no to them. So like, there's a lot of different like things I'm assessing and asking about when someone presents a case like that.
So in other words, that's one of the times when if a couple feels like there's a disparity in libido and they've tried to deal with it on their own and it's not really working, that's a class, like that would be the kind of an example of something that should be or could be taken to a sex therapist to work through.
So I look at it like this. If it's causing constant turmoil, if it's preventing, you know, I always say the perk of predictability. Do you have a sense, is your sex life such that you could predict that if you have sex, it will be a positive experience? Or does it often lead to disagreements, right? Is it associated with a lot of negativity? I also find that it's important assessing, do you have recent positive memories of positive sex with your spouse? So that's why vacations are helpful. Not because, you know, I've read some study that the effect of vacation only lasts 4 hours when you get back. So if you come back from vacation on like a Sunday night, like by like the middle of your workday on Monday, like the effect of your vacation is gone. But they say that it has to do with the anticipation, that the anticipation of the vacation is helpful. But I find for couples what's helpful about it is, even though the effect of the vacation might wear off from like feeling well rested, when you have like a more recent positive experience that you can remember where you had positive sex, even if right now things aren't going well, or you're strained, or you feel like you're under backup generator, if you have more recent positive memories of sex, that's going to help you than, let's say, a couple that it's been a while. And I want to throw out there also that I have very long answers, clearly, that there are couples I find where if they had trauma relationship-wise when it comes to their sex life. And when I say trauma, I don't just mean like sex without consent. I mean just like sex being just not going smoothly, not working out, creating a lot of conflict, a lot of strife, a lot of sadness. If they have that early on in their marriage and it's not really addressed early on, and then they start having children and it's still not addressed, I find like the issues just pile up and they don't have a bank of positive memories that are able to carry them through difficult times. So my answer to people is yes, couples struggle with their sex lives. I don't care how much on social media people are sitting on each other's laps, writing public love letters to their spouses. And I'm like, you live with them. Like, can't you share your love letter to them in person? Like, wouldn't it be weird if you showed up to shul and on the shul bulletin board, somebody posted the Hallmark card that their spouse gave them for their birthday? You'd be like, why are you posting that here? So I don't know. Anyway, but I don't care how horny the people you're seeing in their social media albums are. Like, at the end of the day, it's the kind of thing where every couple has their own situation going on. And it's really about getting a sense of where you're at and what works for you. And are you guys feeling like you're able to troubleshoot this? If you're talking to someone for help, but you don't feel like you can talk openly about your sex life, if you're talking to a Rav, but you don't feel like you're able to really tell the Rav what's going on, then there's going to be a limit to how much the Rav can help you. And I really encourage people to try to talk to people who have an understanding of HIPAA, of privacy laws, because if you don't feel safe with who you're sharing it with, then I don't know how that's going to be a helpful person to ask.
Okay, so another question. How do you suggest couples navigate situations when one spouse's physical body has changed, like weight gain, any other hormonal changes, I imagine, and its effect on how the other might be, you know, physically attracted to them?
Okay, so this definitely happens for people. Of course, I have follow-up questions because it's like, is this about weight gain or is this about self-care? Right. I think there's a difference between seeing a spouse who their body changed because they're really not taking care of themselves versus they take care of themselves as best as they can, but there's just natural changes that happen as the years go on. I think that poor self-care can be a big turnoff for people when they feel like their spouse isn't taking care of themselves, because it, number one, it brings up fear of like, if your spouse is not taking care of themselves well and isn't very healthy, it could bring up fear of something happening to their spouse health-wise. But I also think there's like anger sometimes for people of like, why am I not important enough for my spouse to take better care of themselves? Or why are my kids not important enough for my spouse to take better care of themselves? So that like self-care thing is a very, I find is like a triggering point for people. But that's kind of my follow-up to that is like, are we talking about like natural changes with time? Like, you know, as people get older, they age and bodies change and things like that. Or is this a situation of like the person like really doesn't take care of themselves? So it's not just like changes in their body, but it's like what those changes represent for you. So one of the most common questions I ask people in therapy is like, what's the hardest part of this for you? And if you ask 10 people that question, you will hear 10 different answers of what's the hardest part of this for you.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Okay. As an older single, how do you suggest one copes with constant sexual urges and feel satisfaction when there's craving, but it's not easy to, within halacha at least, to do anything about that?
So I dodge halachic and hashkafic questions. Told ya.
What are any recommendations for singles though, in general, when it comes to libido and sexual urges?
Well, masturbation is very normal.
Okay.
Masturbation is normal. It's a very healthy aspect of life for people. There's a lot of shame around it for people, especially for women. But I'm not going to like comment on like halachic or hashkafic aspect. Like from what I understand, there's no halachic. But I mean, you could correct me if I'm wrong.
For women, but, it's a different question than for men, for sure.
Yeah. But for women, from what I understand, there's nothing wrong with it for women.
Thank you. And okay. Do you have any suggestions for enhancing postmenopausal sex, both psychological libido and physical comfort?
Okay. So one thing that happens with postmenopausal sex for many women is there's vaginal dryness. So sometimes sex and intercourse can become more difficult because the vaginal tissue loses some of its elasticity. And so as there's changes in testosterone and estrogen, that can affect vaginal tissue. So part of it is also just like making sure your equipment's okay. Because if you don't feel confident in your equipment, or if you feel like you have faulty equipment, you don't really want to show up for the game, or you don't feel as excited to show up for the game. So I always say with anyone who's dealing with menopause is just, even just from a physiological perspective, is there vaginal irritation? Is there vaginal dryness? And then I think it also can become like a negative cycle, because if you're not having regular intercourse, so when you do have intercourse, that can then become more uncomfortable because the muscles are not as limber, so to speak. So I always tell anyone who's like going through menopause or postmenopause to make sure that if there is irritation or any sort of pain that they're experiencing, to talk to their OBGYN, talk to their gynecologist, talk to a pelvic floor therapist to deal with any irritation in that regard. Because like I said, if you're having any sort of pain or discomfort during intercourse, that will affect your libido. There's no question about it. Because why would you want to do an activity that, like, who wants to go to the dentist? Like, why would you want to do an activity that you associate with pain? I don't care how much the dentist advertises that they have painless, whatever, virtual, you can watch a movie on the ceiling. We have an association of pain with the dentist. People don't want to go. So I think for anyone who's dealing with menopause, it's very common for people to deal with dryness, which can affect libido. I also think part of it has to do with where people are at within their relationship. There are people that I find exercise can help their libido, not just from a like physiological perspective, but just kind of coming to terms with your body. And dealing with your body and the way it's changing. And when you can respect your body and the strength that it has, you can see your body more in this kind of holistic way versus what you're losing, and how menopause can bring up a lot of emotions for people. I've actually, while you're bringing up the question of menopause, I've been wondering about this for a while. I've actually noticed quite a few. I used to work at this place, Maze Sexual Health. I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Bracheva Marcus. So I worked there for 5 years. So I saw a lot of women, you know, across the age range. And I noticed a certain pattern that there were women who, when they were around menopause age or postmenopause, were reporting more feelings about possible histories of sexual assault. And it was things that they didn't necessarily think about for a long time. And now they're finding at middle age, they're starting to think about it more. And I think there were a couple of reasons. I think number one, we see sexual abuse more in the news, you know, Bill Cosby, Kavanaugh, like anytime there's been like a big case, it's been all over the news. I also think part of it is that for some women, menopause age, they're looking at their sexuality sometimes from a grieving perspective, or it's developing a different type of, I referenced earlier about meaning of what sex means for you. Sex starts to mean something different when it's really not about procreating. And that's not even an option on the table anymore. Even just if you're living with a partner and now you could be having more sex given your schedule and that you're not, you know, menstruating at all. Some people that brings up sex for them as well. I also noticed that there were some women that they were starting to think more about these past sexual abuse incidents. And I would ask, you know, how old are your kids? And some of them, their own sexual assaults had been when they were, let's say, college age or early 20s. And they had daughters who were around the same age and were going to college. So that opened it up. But anyway, I asked a friend of mine who is a neuroscientist, and I said, can you tell me if from a brain perspective, if the amygdala, if the limbic system, if there are changes through menopause that can lend themselves to possibly having shifts in your emotional functioning with anxiety, depression, and possibly trauma? So she told me there is definitely stuff that could back that up. I don't have anything concrete I could give you in terms of study, but I just want to throw that out there. I'm not trying to scare people, by the way. Like I don't want to scare people here, but I think it's important for us to have these conversations because menopause is not talked about and there's a lot of confusion and there are a lot of women that basically their way of learning about menopause is that it feels socially acceptable to just complain about hot flashes, but then like they're like sitting up late at night at 1 a.m. because they can't sleep and they're, you know, looking online to try to find out like what's normal during menopause. So going back to the original question is I think it depends on the situation. Anytime someone tells me they have low libido, there's many different things that could be affecting. It could be physiological, it could be hormonal, it could be relational. It could be, there's so many different pieces that could be involved. So my answer is there's a lot of other questions.
Got it. Okay. That might be your answer to this one too. But is there any advice you would give to a woman who doesn't climax easily? I guess that would be a separate question. So I won't ask it, but how can I get myself to be in the moment and stay in the moment?
Okay. So we're talking a couple, that's a great question. It's very, very common. So we're touching on a question there about mindfulness, of being able to be in the moment, okay? And that's a skill that's not just about sex. That's also a skill that's about just like life in general, right? Being able to be present in the moment. I think that with climaxing is a real mind-body experience. So, and I don't know if the person is talking about climaxing with a partner, but I do tell people if you're having trouble climaxing with a partner and you've never climaxed at all, so it's definitely worth practicing by yourself first. Because for some people, having an orgasm is scary. First time, you're like scared. What's gonna feel like? What's gonna be like? They've also wrapped so much identity around it. Like I've asked people, I'm like, listen, like if you have an orgasm or when you have that orgasm, like what will that say about you? You know, and for a lot of women, it's like, I'll feel normal. Or my partner will be happy. Like it brings up a lot. So I'm always curious from people, you know, what's the hardest part of this for you, right? For some people, it's that they're frustrated with their bodies and themselves that it's not happening the way they want. For other people, it's more of this stress from their partner that they feel like their partner is disappointed that they're not having an orgasm because it makes their partner feel inadequate. So then we're looking at another angle, right? If you're trying to have an orgasm, but you have a partner like breathing down your back, like waiting for it to happen, then like, you know, pleasure under pressure does not feel like pleasure. So in terms of kind of understanding the scene, I think that matters. I think if somebody feels like it's hard to be present, I think that that's a skill that they could practice in general, not just around sex, but just what does it mean to be present? And also what does it mean to be present with a sense of curiosity as opposed to this like agenda of what has to happen right now? Because sometimes I feel like the more you chase that orgasm, the more elusive it feels.
And on the other end of the gender spectrum, how do you have any suggestions for how to help one's husband if he suffers from a form of erectile dysfunction, et cetera?
Okay. Yeah, that's really difficult because there's also like there's so much shame. There's so much shame around it. And there are many men who, when they struggle with it, they kind of shut down or they don't want to talk about it. And so you want to be there for them. So something I do like to tell people is that the worst time to have vulnerable conversations about failure is when you're both naked. So when we're dealing with these types of issues, you know, you want to find times that you can talk about it where it's not as raw. And sometimes it might be like asking a partner of like, hey, you know, I don't know what your pet name might be, but like, you know, hey, sweetie, listen, like, I love you. And I want to support you as best as I can. Like, how can I be most supportive to you? Now, sometimes part of the pressure could be related to trying to conceive. I mean, there are men that really, when they're under pressure, you know, it's very difficult for them to ejaculate and they feel performance anxiety. There are men who have erectile dysfunction because the first year or two of marriage, there was always pain during intercourse. So their penis got confused because their penis was like, hey, am I allowed to enjoy this? I don't know. She's cringing, but she's telling me to keep going. I don't know. Right. So there's like a lot of pieces. Also, I don't know if the erectile dysfunction could be related to medications they're on. Like there's different pieces, but I think what's helpful is to like be able to create conversation in a very gentle way where you could sit and talk about it when you're not undressed and ask them like, how can I help you in those moments? But also to see like, are there times where it seems to happen more often than other times? Are there certain positions where it happens more? There are doctors who treat this, urologists who treat sexual dysfunction, who treat erectile dysfunction. There's so much shame for men to get help for it, but you know, these conditions can get better. So part of it is just kind of staying curious about like where their partner is at, and also seeing if there's ways that you can create conversation about it where it's not under pressure for them to be able to like answer you and perform right there.
Okay. What if I'm just tired all the time and it's not even necessarily my regular personality, but between pregnancy and breastfeeding or other parts of life, I've been tired for the past 5 years. And, you know, how to explain that this is the current reality, but it's not necessarily the reality all the time. And how do I communicate to my husband that I want to be there for him? I don't want to be ignoring his needs, but it's just that I just can't right now, or I feel like I can't right now. I'm just tired.
So a couple of things. I think even just the way we conceptualize that, like his needs, which like is really common for people to talk about that. And we often are told that, you know, men have needs. And if it's conceptualized as like men have needs, then it's like, okay, your baby has needs. And then you're like, oh, and then there's you with your needs, right? It's like an overgrown toddler. So I think even just like the language is something for us to ask ourselves. Is it that they have needs, or is they long to be close? And this is something they miss and they feel close to you when they're connecting to you in that way sexually. So I think even just like asking ourselves that phraseology is that a word, but even just asking ourselves that in terms of, you know, cause he has needs, I'm neglecting his needs versus he misses me and he wants to be close to me. And what does that mean for me? And cause I think even that, if you say to the guy, like, listen, I know you have needs, but I'm really sorry. I know I'm really tired. Like, I don't think that makes him feel better when he hears it that way. Cause then he feels like he's a nag who's like, you know, yanking on your skirt. Well, not like little kids do, but yanking on your skirt in a different way. But I don't think men appreciate when we categorize them as like they have needs. Right. But it just feels more socially acceptable to be like, oh yeah, they have needs versus no, they're actually vulnerable and have emotions and miss being close to their spouse and want to feel connected and can very often appreciate other types of touch besides just having a penis inside a vagina. And then when someone's saying they're tired, you know, tired is normal. But I often say to people, okay, are there areas of your life where you're expending energy that is necessary, but there's could be areas of your life where you're expending energy and it's not necessary. So, you know, people sometimes underestimate how much energy you expend watching Instagram stories and, you know, being a fly on the wall of other people's lives. And it actually, like, it sucks energy out of you. It's depleting. So sometimes I tell people, like, can you look at your Instagram diet? Like, is it the first thing you look at while you're nursing? Is that what you're looking at? Like, I really find for a lot of people, they don't even realize that you're turning to your phone as like to take a break and decompress, but it actually like depletes you even more. I don't look at social media the first 3 hours of the day. It's the most freeing thing in my life. Because it's like, I'm starting the day. I want to be peppy. I want to be my own brain. I don't want to be like hearing about your outfit of the day. Like it's, I got to be here. I need clarity, laser focus. And I have a lot more energy that way, you know? So I tell people like, yeah, there's things in your life that you can't control in terms of energy wise, but I find that there are things that like, we don't realize how much technology sucks our energy out too.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to leave off with, I guess, I think two more questions. The first one is when/how do you recommend teaching our children, both daughters and or sons, about sex, about sexuality, and you know, what are your recommendations when it comes to chinuch habanim in this area?
So I think that's a whole program, Lynn. And I could connect you with colleagues who do that. Rachel Tuckman has like a talk on YouTube about that. Like there's already stuff out there. Like if you look up Rachel Tuckman's talks on YouTube, there's definitely stuff already out there. And I have colleagues who could do a whole talk on that for you. Yeah, this is from a what?
I was just going to say, are these from a firm perspective? Just curious, or from a secular perspective?
No, these are from therapists. Okay. So they understand that, but I think it's, I'm not a child therapist. So even though I have ideas about teaching kids about sex, I like to stay in my own lane and I'm not a child therapist. So I think it's the kind of thing where a child therapist should be giving a talk to parents about talking to their children.
Okay. So then the last question I think you will be able to answer, being that it's coming from women about women and for their own marriages, are there any helpful resources that you would recommend for observant couples to improve their sex life, just in general, but also, I guess, like their emotional intimacy, but also their sex life?
Okay. So one, I'm going to type in a title right now, actually.
Thank you.
Okay, so one book is Dr. Sue Johnson, Hold Me Tight. It's a great book. John Gottman books are good. And also books by, there's a recent book by Dr. David Ribner and Tali Rosenbaum. I think it's called Ani Ladodi. And that I think would be really helpful because it's by two from therapists in Israel.
Great. All right. Okay. I mean, just because it's 9:30, I think everyone could, you know, if they weren't tired, I'm sure they would go on forever. There are definitely more questions that we didn't get to. And I'm sure there are more questions in people's heads, but really, Rachel, you were amazing and super helpful. Yeah. And that I hope we ran the gamut in terms of the questions that were asked. I apologize to anyone if I didn't get to your particular question, but I hope that Rachel gave you resources and other ways to explore whatever questions are, you know, are the issues that are there for you. So thank you, Rachel. You are awesome.
Thank you. Have a good night, Chicago.
Thank you so much to both of you. We really appreciate it, Rachel. That was amazing. Lynn, thank you so much for moderating. And thank you everyone for participating. We really appreciate it. And are glad everyone was able to be here to open up this extremely important discussion. So thank you so much. And again, in the chat is the link to find out more about the Neely Hotline.
And next week we have an event with Reva Prell, who is a pelvic floor PT. So a lot of things that Rachel was mentioning will hopefully be addressed next week from a different perspective, but an important one as well. Emma, you want to give details for that?
Yes, you can check. You can check out, I will type it all in the chat, neelytorah.org, at Neely Women's Learning on Instagram, Neely Chicago Institute for Women's Learning on Facebook. You will find the information for part two of this series, which will be with Reva Prail on Pelvic Floor 101. So many things that Rachel referenced are physical aspects of things that we can actually improve through exercise and things that Reva knows a lot more about than I do. So tune in on Monday night at 8 p.m. You will be able to find the link through all of those forums. I will write that all in the chat for anyone who missed it. And thank you so much for joining tonight, everyone. Have a good night. Thank you.